Good afternoon, everybody. As Jakob pointed out, my name is Charles van der Walt. I'm from a company called SensePost in South Africa, where I'm one of the directors and a founding member. So we've come a very far way from South Africa to Japan. And it's a big honor and a privilege for us to be here. Thank you very much. The talk today is titled, When the Tables Turn. And it's a comment on a technology that we've called Passive Strike Back. The primary premise behind the technology is that the way network defenses are currently designed, they are basically passive in the sense that they wait for the attacker to attack and prepare and attempt to keep the attacker out. Yeah, I'd like to check if the translation still works. Can I get an indication if the translation is still working? Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. I understand, thank you. Yes, so the basic premise is that at the moment, network defense technologies are passive in nature. What that means is that we wait for the attacker, and when the attacker comes, we try and keep that attacker out. And essentially, the attacker is free to carry on attacking as often and as frequently as he or she wishes, at no cost to himself. At the same time, there's a very high cost to the defender, who needs to pay for the bandwidth, who needs to buy the equipment, and who needs to employ people to respond to these attacks the whole time. Now, yesterday, in the question and answer session, I heard one of the speakers say that an attacker only has to get lucky once. What that means is that while the network administrator is trying all the time to cover all of the holes, the attacker only has to find one hole in your network defenses, and using that hole, he can then successfully penetrate your network. What that means is that the attacker can just carry on and carry on and carry on at no cost to himself until the defending team makes a mistake and the attacker succeeds. The thinking behind this paper and behind this talk is that if we can make the process of attacking for the attacker as expensive as it is for the defender, then that will equal the odds in the struggle between the attacker and the defender. In thinking about this concept, we made use of a number of analogies. These are examples that we see from nature and from other fields of study that serve to support the thinking that we have about the passiveness of current network security systems. The one analogy that I really like is from a form of martial art that we have in South Africa. It is a martial art that is practiced by the Xhosa and the Zulu people. I'm sure everyone here has seen the Zulu people. They're the strong black warrior-like people that you always see in the movies about Africa. They practice a form of martial art called the Iintonga, which is spelled I-I-N-T-O-N-G-A. And Iintonga is a stick fighting art where both players, both combatants, use two sticks. The one stick is used primarily in attack, and the other stick is used primarily in defense. A good player, if he's well-practiced and well-skilled, using both his sticks in defense, will be almost impossible to strike. It is only when he opens his one stick in order to strike his opponent that his defenses go down and he himself becomes vulnerable. And it's exactly this thinking that we want to apply in the concept of passive strike back. Our thinking is that when the attacker strikes at us, in a sense he's dropping his guard and making himself vulnerable. At that point, we may be in a position to strike back at him. And because this point only happens when he strikes at us, we are 100% sure that we are dealing with a malicious attacker. Of course, one of the risks in a system like this, and I'm sure it's a question that will get asked, is if you're going to strike back at somebody that's striking at you, how can you be sure that you're striking back at someone who's malicious? How can we be certain that we don't strike back at somebody who is in fact simply an innocent bystander? And if you use this analogy of the intonga, and you understand that we will only strike back at the point that the attacker has dropped his own defenses in order to strike at us, then you can begin to understand how possibly we can avoid involving innocent bystanders. Later, I will also give you some examples, some technical demonstrations. And doing these, you will start to see some of these principles coming into play. I'd like to also just make use of an analogy from the animal world that supports the use of passive strike back as a defensive mechanism. If you look at the animal world, then you see animals deploying a number of common mechanisms for defending themselves. One of those mechanisms is a mechanism called crypsis, which is essentially camouflage. It is the mechanism by which one animal disguises itself as something else, or even as another animal, to avoid being attacked. A classic example of this is the stick insect that disguises itself as a stick, so that it doesn't get eaten. The second mechanism that you see is a mechanism called active defense under animals. In this mechanism, what happens is that the animal makes itself unattractive to be eaten. For example, you see a poisonous frog, which will never hurt anybody until another animal tries to eat it, at which point the poison that is in this frog's flesh will be released and the other animal will be poisoned by it. This is a classic example of passive strike back, where the frog is attacking in defense, but only attacks when it is himself attacked. You see some other interesting examples. One is called predator saturation. Predator saturation proceeds from the premise that there are so many of a given species that it doesn't matter if that species gets eaten or not. Essentially, you'll see this behavior in some fishes or in termites. It says that there are 60 billion of these termites. And so if two or three of them get eaten, nobody really minds. And all of these mechanisms we can apply into network security, into network defense, as my examples will show a little bit later. If we look at the world of hacking today, and I refer to specifically now the practice of hacking into networks over the internet, specifically, then we can see a few trends, a few discernible trends. One of those trends, or the one very clear trend, is that hackers are lazy. And by this, I do not mean that they do not want to work. By this I mean that they do not want to do any unnecessary work. My colleague Rulof, back in South Africa, who was largely responsible for some of the ideas in this paper, he's a classical example of this behavior. If Rudolf ever has to do any single activity twice, he'll consider that a failure. In other words, where he sees that a certain task needs to be repeated more than twice, then what he's rather going to do is he's going to build a technology, develop a tool with which the repetition of that process can be automated. And I think that this is very common in hackers. By their nature, hackers will rather invest in the development of a tool or a technology than repeat a certain action by hand. And this brings us to the second trend in hacking that we can discern. And that is that hackers are very dependent on tools and toolboxes. Now, of course, this is not what defines a hacker, but it would be stupid, I guess, for a hacker to do something new when it's already been done before. And so we see in the hacking community this incredible reuse of certain tools and technologies. In fact, even where the hacker is capable of or is inclined to write his own tool to perform a certain task, you will probably find that that tool is not much different from the existing tools that are considered the best in their class that exist already. So, for example, you see things like the port scanner Nmap, which is probably considered the best port scanner in the world. There aren't many ways to write a port scanner better than how Nmap has been written. And there are not many ways to do a port scan differently than how Nmap does it. So a hacker who wants to perform a port scan is going to either use Nmap or use something that behaves exactly like Nmap. And there are many tools that behave like this, where the way that they perform the task in hand is the only way that that task can be performed. And if we're thinking about attacking back or striking back at hackers, this concept is very important to understand. It's important to understand that when a hacker considers attacking a network, there are certain phases that he will go through, certain tests that he will perform, and there are only a very limited number of ways that those tests can be performed. And so we now know something about that hacker and the way he's going to operate, which empowers us in terms of strike back. And again, in a while you'll see why that is true. The other thing that I think is possibly a trend, although I can't prove this, is it comes from a saying that we see in English where it is said that the mechanic's car is often broken. And essentially what that means is that people who spend a lot of their time telling other people how to fix things and telling other people what is broken very often don't spend their time looking at fixing their own things or looking which of their own things are perhaps broken. And so they say that the mechanic's car is often broken. And I wonder whether this is not potentially also true for hackers. In fact, I believe that it is true. For example, a hacker will tell you that you should employ multi-layer security. Security in depth. But is he himself employing multi-layer security or security in depth on his systems? For example, will a hacker place his workstation behind a firewall? Or would the hacker prefer to have his workstation directly connected to the internet where there's no interference from firewalls? Will a hacker run antivirus on his machine? Or would he prefer not to have anything running on his machine that could disrupt his tools and interfere with his tools? Would a hacker who is familiar with Unix and not comfortable in the Windows environment, for example, will he have loaded all the tools and service packs and patches on his machine? Is he running a personal firewall? And if he's not doing all of these things, then he places himself in a position to be attacked back by the networks that he's attacking. And one of the main objectives of strike-back thinking is that we want to ensure that the hacker is forced to do all of these things on his own systems, because that raises the cost for him. And so we can see that the objective of strike-back is not so much that we actually want to attack the hacker. The objective of strike-back is that we want to force the hacker to employ defensive thinking himself, so that he has to go through the same lockdown and security processes that we do, and in this way we raise the cost of the attack for him, and in this way we can even the odds. I think I've covered these points already. So if we analyze an attack on a network over the internet, then I think we can see that there are some phases that are global and which the attacker will always go through. The first of those phases is what we call footprinting. During the footprinting phase, what will happen is that the hacker will attempt to translate, will attempt to derive DNS domains for the target that he's attacking, and he will attempt to translate those DNS domains into IP addresses. This is a logical place for the hacker to start, because the DNS domain is the logical link between the company's, the organization, between the real world entity and the cyber world existence of this company. So the attacker at this point will employ various DNS tools. We will see things like DNS forward queries, DNS reverse queries, and DNS zone transfers. And at the end of it, the attacker will have a list of machine names and IP addresses which can potentially be the target for his attack. Now, many of the targets that the attacker discovers using this method will not necessarily be reachable or alive on the internet. So what this means is that there is no way for the hacker to get a packet to that network, and so there's no way for him to attack it. It's pretty obvious. So what the attacker is going to do is he's going to use a set of tools that we call vitality scanners. And he's going to use these tools to try and determine which machines that he's identified as potential targets are actually alive and can really be attacked. So, typical tools that he will use at this point are ping scans, ICMP ping scans, and TCP ping scans, and various other forms of TCP scans. And at the end of this phase of his attack, the attacker will have a list of machines that are legitimate targets and can be reached. The attacker will then try and discover on these machines which ports are actually open. And the method typically used for this would be a port scanner. And as I pointed out earlier, there are not many different ways to do a port scan. And so the attacker is going to end up using one of a handful of standard tools, like Nmap, for example. And at the end of this phase, he will have a list of TCP ports that are open on this network. He will then proceed to try and map out any vulnerabilities associated with the ports that are open. And most typically, we will use some form of vulnerability scanner for this. Some vulnerability scanners are very general in nature, like for example the NMAP scanner, whereas some other vulnerability scanners are very specific. They will test only for one known vulnerability, typically a vulnerability for which the attacker has a working exploit. Many of the attackers, in going through this process, will catalog the information as they find it. So they will keep a list of the machines that they find, of the ports that they find open on those machines, and of the vulnerabilities that they document for those ports. And most likely they will write that data into a file somewhere, or potentially even into a database. And many of the automated hacking and automated assessment tools that we have do this automatically. Having built a list of potential vulnerabilities, the attacker will then attempt to exploit some of these vulnerabilities. And he'll do this in many cases by using some form of exploit code. And a skilled attacker may write the exploit code himself. But more often than not, he's going to use exploit code that's been written already by somebody else. As we know, hackers are lazy. One very popular tool used by hackers for running exploits is relatively new. It's called the Metasploit framework. Can I perhaps get an indication of who's seen or used the Metasploit framework before? Okay, there are some. The Metasploit framework gives us a collection of technologies, tools, different exploit payloads, and payloads themselves, which an attacker can use to attack vulnerable machines, but also to build new payloads, build new exploits, and new ways of delivering the payloads via exploits. And the Metasploit framework works very well. So as an attacker, I'm unlikely to do something myself if I can do it using the Metasploit framework or another similar framework. And finally, there's a new space, which is the space of web application security. It's a little bit different from traditional vulnerabilities from an attacker's point of view, because the vulnerabilities that we see in a web application are not generally known. Web applications are very often custom written, and so the attacker cannot depend on a scanner to discover those vulnerabilities. But there are still a number of tools and scanners that the attacker can use to try and find perhaps classes of vulnerabilities on that server. Typical tools that we will see here are web spiders or web suckers, and also very popular tools like the at-stake web proxy, which is used to analyze traffic between a client and a server. The traffic can then be intercepted and modified as required. If we examine all of these phases of an attack, and we look at the methodologies, at the technologies, and at the tools that the attacker will typically use, then there are a few things that we can notice that are important. And these things, when we understand them, give us a big advantage over the attacker. The first of them is that all the information that the attacker sees originates from under our control. In essence, on the internet, an attacker is as blind as you are. If it is difficult for you as an administrator to identify an attack, And it's difficult for you as an administrator to realize where an attacker is coming from. Then it is just as difficult for the attacker to know who you are and to know where you are and to know how your systems really look. All of the information that the attacker gets about your network, he gets in response to probes that were sent to your network. Those probes, the response to those probes, all originate from your network. And so all the information that the attacker sees about your network ever originates from you. So in essence, you control exactly what the attacker sees. There's no real concept of a connection or a circuit on the internet. There's only bidirectional communications. Communications from you to the attack, from the attacker to your network, and then from your network back to the attacker. And of course that puts us in as much a position to attack the attacker as the attacker is in a position to attack us. And we can see some examples of the things that we control over what the attacker sees. All the packets that the attacker sees, we control. All the forward and reverse DNS entries, we control. All the service banners that the attacker sees, we control. All the error codes, error messages, etc., that any application generates, we control. All the web pages that the attacker sees when he visits our sites, we control. So where does all that information go if it originates from our network? Well, the attacker fetches it back from our network, and he's going to use various command line tools, databases, and rendering engines to view and analyze and store that data. So, for example, an attacker using a Unix console will pipe the output of commands through cat and grep and more, etc. An attacker might write the output into a database. In fact, there are many tools, particularly network discovery tools and vulnerability scanning tools, that do exactly that. And of course, when the data is displayed by the attacker, we control that also. It's our data that's being displayed. So, for example, a tool that shows information using HTML. Potentially, we have the ability to control how that HTML is ultimately going to look. At this point, I think I'd like to just introduce another concept, and it also comes back to what Cesar said yesterday during the question and answer. He made the statement that hackers are cheaters. And he said, the better a hacker cheats, the better a hacker is at hacking. And if network security administrators start to be cheaters also, then we can even the playing field between the hackers and the administrators. And so, in addition to understanding that we control all the information that the hacker sees, we need to make the shift in our thinking to the point where we start thinking like hackers. Which means that we start thinking like cheaters. And that robs the attacker of the two primary advantages that he had. The first advantage was that he knew things about your network that you didn't know about his network. And the second advantage was that he didn't follow the rules while you did follow the rules. If you can rob him of those two advantages, then the struggle between the attacker and the defender becomes much more even. So when we look at the concept of strike back, we see four primary kinds of strike back. The first kind is strike back, which is aimed at stopping specific identifiable attacks. This is not a particularly new concept. We already see this being deployed by shunning firewalls, IDSs, IPSs, etc. We then see a type of strike back which is designed only to create noise and confusion. This is similar to the analogy that we saw from the animal kingdom, where we see the animals finding strength in numbers. If the attacker is attacking 1,000 machines, which one does he attack? If he thinks that your network has 56,000 hosts in it, which one does he attack? We can then look at a type of strike back which is designed specifically to stop or slow down or paralyze an attacker's tool. And as I pointed out earlier, this is feasible because we can speculate quite accurately about what kinds of tools an attacker is likely to use. And because it's become clear that attackers are very dependent on tools, by attacking his tool, we can slow him down and we can make the attack much more difficult and much more expensive for him. Finally, we can look at a type of attack which is designed to actually attack at the attacker's own host or his network. This kind of attack depends on the fact that the attacker is not implementing the same level of security that he expects us to. And the idea with this kind of attack is not so much that we actually hurt the attacker. The idea with this kind of attack is more that we force him to go through the same hardening processes that we are forced to go through. And in that way, we make the attack more expensive for him. In the examples that follow, you'll see that we can implement these kinds of strike back technologies at almost every level of the OSI stack, OSI stack. Anything that the internet supports, we can manipulate. And I will show you examples of all of these attacks in the sections that follow. So for the next section, I'm going to demonstrate some technologies that we've developed that support some of these ideas. The idea behind these technologies is not so much to develop enterprise commercial tools. The idea is more just to demonstrate that some of these principles are possible. So the tools that I'm going to demonstrate are not of a commercial grade quality. They're all just proof of concept tools. I also need to point out that there are some moral, some legal, some ethical issues around the concept of strike back, which I think still need to be considered. And so in demonstrating these technologies, I do not want to be encouraging people necessarily to implement these systems. I only want to demonstrate their feasibility. I need to make one other disclaimer also. They say there are two very important laws in computers. The one law is called Moore's Law. Essentially, it says that the processing power doubles every year. I think that's correct. So it means that the computer that I buy next year for the same price as I paid for this one will be twice as capable. And there's another important law in computers. It's called Murphy's Law. And it says that anything that can go wrong will go wrong. And so I need to ask you up ahead, as I try and demonstrate these technologies, that if I make any mistakes, that you will have some patience with me. The first technology that I want to demonstrate is a strike back against DNS queries. In the picture that you see is an automated map of the SensePost network that was generated by Qualys' network mapping technology. It's an online system that you can connect to over the internet. You can enter a DNS domain, and the Qualys system will then generate a map of your network based on the DNS queries that it performs. And what you see from this map is that the Qualys scanner has absolutely no idea how the SensePost network looks. SensePost only has 12 people. There's no way that we have this number of computers. And now the attacker is going to be forced to go through each one of these results by hand, examining each one to see which are the real results and which are the fake results. And the way we achieve this is simply by modifying the behavior of our name server in two ways. The first way is that we support wildcards for queries that do not exist. In other words, any query for a machine name that doesn't actually exist in our net domain will return a result. And we can control exactly where that result is. So the attacker can get the impression that we have machines located all over the world. In addition, we can mislead the attacker into believing that machines belonging to other organizations are in fact our machines. And in this way, we can perhaps trick the attacker into attacking networks where he really shouldn't attack because he's going to get into trouble. The second technique that we can employ at this level is that we can allow DNS zone transfers that are recursive and never terminate. So when the attacker requests our zone file, we send it to him, but the zone file is infinitely big. We just continue to send him more and more and more and more entries. And again, in this way, we not only confuse him, we also slow him down, and we remove his ability to use automated tools. We can take this technique a level further by breaking the rules that govern the format of DNS names. According to the RFCs, there are certain characters that a DNS name should never contain. But if we modify the name server, we can cause it to break those rules. And so you can see us inserting entries, for example, like that one. And what that is that's an entry which contains an HTML formatting tag. Now let me give an example of where something like this would come into play. The attacker performs a zone transfer against our network. The zone transfer will look something like this. But he uses an automated tool to produce the zone transfer. And that automated tool generates an HTML report. HTML report will typically look something like this. Right? Any of us who've done these kinds of scans will have seen these kinds of reports. This is a report generated by a technology that we developed. Over here we see the entry regarding the zone transfer, which is possible. It's rated as a medium-level vulnerability. And the system allows us to view the output of the zone transfer if we wish. If I select to view the zone transfer, what in fact happens is that the JavaScript, which was embedded in the result, executes in my browser. Meaning that I now have the ability to execute code. It's only JavaScript code, but it is code that I can execute on the attacker's computer. And this is a very decent form of strike back, because it will only occur if the attacker fetches that data to his own computer. Of course, there are many other ways that we could implement the same concept. For example, by injecting shell commands into the DNS results, or by injecting SQL injection strings into the DNS results, which would have an impact if the attacker wrote that data into his database. This is an example of the tool Visual Route, which performs a trace route using UDP and then attempts to map the location of the machines that it discovers on its path to a database that it has of geographical locations. At this point, it's important to understand how traceroute works. Essentially, what happens is that the scanning tool, the trace routing tool, will send out a series of UDP packets on some high port with different time to live flags set. For every hop along the way, the scanning tool receives an ICMP TTL expired packet back. So we have a classic example of a probe and response technology. The scanner, or the traceroute tool, sends a probe out in the form of UDP packets and receives the response in the form of ICMP time to live expired packets. And those time to live expired packets originate from our network. And so they can be spoofed. And so when we identify a trace route that is coming into the network, we can very easily build technology that responds with spoofed ICMP packets indicating a completely misleading route or route. And so we can mislead the attacker into thinking that his trace route is useless, or in fact even into attacking networks which are located very far away from our own. And again, this is a classical form of defense that we see coming from the animal kingdom. As I'm going through these different examples, if there are any questions regarding exactly that example, at that point, then I'd like to encourage you to ask the question. And specifically, if the question is regarding any of the technical detail of the example being shown. Of course, we can now do anything on the network level to trick the attacker's tools. For example, if the attacker performs a ping scan against our network, what we see here is an NMAP ping scan. It'll essentially send out a series of ICMP and TCP ping packets to the network that I specify. And what I have running in front of that network, near the firewall, is a tool which essentially goes into promiscuous mode. It has a list which correlates with my firewall rules, which suggests which machines are actually up and active on the network. And this tool will respond on behalf of any machines that aren't active or aren't up on the network. And if I've selected the right network, then we should see the response. In this case, I'm striking back at ICMP ping scans which give the attacker a misleading perception of the size and the nature of my network. Of course, I could do exactly the same thing for TCP ports. So for any given machine, I could pretend that the machine has services running, which it doesn't. In fact, we could even build in an element of randomness into the system, so that if the attacker were to look at our attack, our network this week, it would look one way. Next week, it would look moderately different. And again, the attacker is now forced to examine each and every one of these results to determine whether, in fact, these machines exist and whether they are real. Once again, this is a classic example of which we see from the animal kingdom. Before I proceed, are there any questions on the topics that we've covered to this point? Okay. The next example I want to give you, we take the strike back one level up in the OSI stack. And we're going to strike back by manipulating banners. It's already very common for administrators to change their banners or to hide their banners. In this example, we're going to show you how banners can be completely misleading and perhaps even dangerous for the attacker. So most scanning tools, port scanners and vulnerability scanners, will make use of banner information. So for example, it would be typical for the attacker to scan in this way. This is a simple port scan being conducted against the target. And the port scan identifies that there are two ports open. The next step would be for the attacker to examine the services running on that port. And in this case, we can do it very simply using Telnet. For example, on port 21. Observe the banner that comes back. Now, this banner, in fact, does three things all at the same time. The first is that it reports itself to be numerous different types of FTP server all at the same time. This means that a vulnerability scanner that depends on banner information would report this FTP server vulnerable to many, many different kinds of vulnerabilities, which in fact don't exist. The second thing that we see is the HTML codes, similar to the previous example we saw with the DNS, and also shell commands like rm-rf, etc. So the idea being that when the attacker starts to parse this information, for example by writing it into a database or by grepping through the file, that we can manipulate his console by injecting these characters into the data that he used. There's something else that I want you to notice, which becomes much more interesting. If I were to make an FTP to that server, observe the title of the console as it comes through. When the connection is established, the title of the attacker's extern changes. And this is done using standard extern meta characters, which are used very normally to set things like the title bar and the text color, and the text size and the background color, etc. So in essence, what's happening is when the attacker connects to our service, he is calling down into his own external control characters which change the behavior of his terminal. And so we see that we have an even greater ability to manipulate and attack the attacker's own environment. And in the examples that follow, I'll show you exactly how we can do that. Is that clear? Are there any questions? The next example that I want to show you is of a vulnerability scanner. These vulnerability scanners all work essentially in exactly the same way, which is that they send a probe to the target system and then try and analyze the results for some indication that the target system is vulnerable to the vulnerability in question. There's a tool called Necto, which is a very common CGI scanner, meaning that it tests specifically for web server vulnerabilities. So I'm going to launch Necto against the server. I'm going to launch Necto. Now observe the behavior. Necto is reporting a vulnerability for almost every item in its database. And we achieve this because we've configured the web server always to respond with an HTTP 200 error code, regardless of what the request is. Because of this, Necto isn't able to differentiate between files and items and objects that really exist on the system and ones that don't. Now, Necto and other vulnerability scanners often have the ability to detect when a server is behaving in this way. And in fact, a more intelligent scanner like Nessus will then alter the way in which it finds vulnerabilities based on its understanding of how the server is responding. But we can easily bypass this by making the server's responses random. And by sending random responses for objects that don't exist on the server, we can make it impossible for the scanner ever to know whether a given object exists or not. At Black Hat in Las Vegas earlier this year, there was a speaker by the name of Samuel Shah, and he gave a presentation on a tool that he's developed called PHP Guard, which implements exactly this kind of thinking for web servers. And essentially what this does is to rob the attacker of his ability to use an automated scanning tool, without at all changing the experience of the website for the user. Are there any questions at this point? There's another tool that is commonly used in assessing web applications and web servers, and it's called a spider, web spider. A web spider essentially works by following all the links on a site and saving each of the pages that it finds to a local disk. So we've developed a tool we call Spider Trap, which is essentially a very simple CGI which creates additional links back to itself. So if you were to surf to this CGI using a browser, you would see something that looks like this. This is just a set of links that link back to the same CGI. If you were to click on any of those links, you would see another page of links of the same kind. And so on forever. Essentially what it means is that a web spider that follows the first link into the spider trap can never leave the spider trap. It'll just keep following links like this forever. And because the new links are created with random names, the spider has no way of knowing that it's in the trap. And once again, we've robbed the attacker of his ability to use an automated tool to analyze our website. The user himself, the regular user, is protected from this trap because we make the link to the spider trap on the website invisible, which is very easy to use, to do. For example, using a transparent GIF, or simply by hiding the link inside of the HTML. And because the spider looks at the content of the HTML, the actual HTML source, it will see and follow the link, whereas the user will never see it and will therefore never click on it. We can take this concept a little bit further. Assuming that the attacker does identify a resource on our website that he wishes to see. So for example, we can create a directory on our website called admin or backup. Or we can create a legitimate object like one of the IIS default sample pages that might be interesting to an attacker. Now once again, none of the legitimate users would ever see these objects because there are no links to them from our page. The attacker only identifies the object if he runs brute force scanning tools. At the point that the attacker then uses his browser to view the object in question, we can send him active content. And that active content could be things like JavaScript, like Flash, or even Java. And because the attacker's browser now becomes a small runtime environment, essentially the attacker is allowing us to send him active content which will be executed on his machine. Now there's a very simple example of this, which I think many of you may have seen before. This is a small HTML page which consists of HTML, JavaScript, and Flash. The Flash generates the images and it makes a noise. It makes a noise like that. The JavaScript remaps the Alt F4 key on the keyboard so that using Alt F4 will no longer close the windows. In fact, using Alt F4 will just open more similar windows. Luckily, I run a Macintosh, so I can switch it off. What's important to understand is that we have now sent the attacker both Java and Flash. which execute on the attacker's machine. So unless the attacker's machine is completely patched to all of the Java and JavaScript-based vulnerabilities that have existed in his browser now becomes vulnerable to attack by us. In fact, in recent times, there have been vulnerabilities in other forms of content, like in the JPEG file format, which can cause buffer overruns on Windows machines. So if we can lure the attacker into downloading some of this content on our machine, we now have the ability to execute any kind of code on his machine. And once again, the normal user is protected because he will never visit that part of the site. The next example that I want to show you strikes back at an attacker who's using the Metasploit framework. At this point, it becomes a little bit more complicated. What you see in the top screen is the attacker's computer. And the attacker is going to run the Metasploit framework, and he's going to select a specific vulnerability. So that's me evoking the Metasploit command line interface. This is the name of the exploit which I wish to execute. The IP address of the remote host. I think this is the address. The IP address of the remote port. The local port which I wish to use. The payload which I wish to send. So if I've done that all correctly, what I will be doing is I'll be launching the IIS printer overflow exploit against the remote host on port 80. I will then be opening a listen socket for a reverse connection from the exploited machine back to my machine. So at this point, this is the attacker. At the point at the bottom here, I'm launching my strikeback tool. My strikeback tool is going to do three things. The first is it will emulate the behavior of a vulnerable IIS server. The second is, on receiving an attack, it will send back information which looks as if it's vulnerable. In this case, it's going to send back a copy of a Windows shell. This is what the attacker expects to see if his exploit works. And then thirdly, I'm going to send back the same Xterm control characters that I showed you with the FTP banner. And I'm going to start to manipulate the way the attacker's Xterm works. And I'll first show you how it behaves and then try and explain it to you. I launched the exploit from the attacker. The connection comes in, and you see that the attacker gets the remote shell on the machine. Except that the shell he gets is not really a shell. It's the shell that we're sending him. At this point, the attacker will do what's natural, and he'll hit carriage return to to see whether he gets a response. Observe the behavior now. You now see two things happening that are a little bit difficult to understand. The files that you see at the top there are from a directory listing that's being executed on the attacker's own machine. The DNS queries that we see coming back here are queries that the attacker's machine is sending back to me and which I'm picking up off the network using a sniffer. In essence, what has happened is that the attacker has executed a command on his own machine. And I'll show you in a minute exactly how that works. I'm now going to change the behavior of my strike back tool. So I can run the strike back tool like so. I set the port that it should listen on. I'm going to set it to operate in visible mode so that we can observe its behavior. And I'm going to instruct it to execute the alias command on the attacker's machine. And now we need to watch two things carefully. The first is we need to watch the title of the exterm up at the top here. And the second is we need to watch what's on the attacker's command prompt when this whole process is finished. So the attacker launches his exploit again. Watch the title bar change and change back. And in fact, what has happened was that we sent these external control characters. We sent them in two batches. In the first batch, we set the title bar using control characters. In the second batch, we copied the value of the title bar to the command prompt. Over there. And so when the attacker, believing that he's now got a DOS prompt, hits enter, the command that I specify is run on his machine with his privileges. The reason that you didn't see that information the first time is because I run the strike back tool in invisible mode. And all that invisible mode does is that we use the same external control characters to control the foreground color and the background color of the attacker's exterm. And so the information is exactly the same, but the attacker can't see it. All the attacker sees is what looks like a DOS prompt because we set the color of this text to contrast the color of the background. The actual commands, the color of the text is the same as the color of the background. And so when the attacker hits enter, he executes the command that we specify with his privileges on his computer, thereby giving us the ability to attack back at his machine and at his entire network. Are there any questions at that point? Okay, I want to move on to the last example that I have. In this example, we are looking at defending web servers against attackers who use scanning tools. The first thing to understand about this is the architecture that we apply. We insert a piece of hardware or a piece of software in front of the web server that we're protecting. in a similar way to how a firewall would work. In fact, the StrikeBack software could run on the same machine as the server. But conceptually, it's two different things. The purpose of this form of StrikeBack is to act as what we've called a human detector. In other words, we want to differentiate a normal user using a normal browser from an attacker using some form of scanning tool. Now, what kinds of scanning tools am I talking about? CGI scanners, for example, web spiders, for example, or inline web proxies, like Adstack's web proxy. I want to identify and stop the use of these kinds of tools. This doesn't make my web server any less vulnerable. It just makes it much, much harder for the attacker to identify the vulnerabilities. The principle we apply in doing this is very simple. We make the assumption that a user using a regular browser will be able to understand and execute Flash, whereas a scanning tool will not be able to understand or execute Flash. This is a pretty fair assumption. In fact, most scanning tools, if they could understand Flash, would no longer work in the way we expect them to. So how it works is like this. The first time that the client connects to our web server, we request from the client a cookie. If the client already has the cookie at that point, we set up a session level connection to the web server, and the client continues to use the web server as normal. If the client does not have a cookie, we look for a request string in the connection coming through. If the client has a valid request string, we will issue him with a cookie. The next connection that the client makes, he then has the cookie, and he can use the site as normal. If the client has neither a cookie nor a valid request string, then we send that client a little piece of Flash, which will execute in the browser. Now, most browsers will support Flash. All that the Flash does is to generate a unique request string and initiate a new connection to the website with that request string. So the next time the connection comes through, the client doesn't have a cookie, but it does have a valid request string. And so we can issue the cookie, and from that point the client can carry on working as normal. The net effect of this is very simply that if the client cannot execute Flash, then the client cannot access any pages on our website. And we implement this at a network level. So the website is completely protected from any request from a browser that can't first execute our Flash. We can observe this behavior quite clearly. I believe this is the correct slide. That's a client connecting to the website using a regular browser. And you can see that there's very little impact to the client. If I disable support for Flash, and I reset the browser and clear the cache, Can I revisit the site? Should we get that? I get that. I get empty. And the reason for that is very clear. When we view the source, it's quite simply because the first piece of content being sent to the client is the shockwave flash. Until this client can execute that piece of flash and get the unique session string, the client will be blocked from the web server on the network level. We can see this behavior very nicely if we use AppStack's web proxy. The web proxy allows us to analyze the requests between a browser and a server very nicely. There's the connection. Okay, I seem to have this data cached, so I'm not going to show you that. But I think that the principle is clear. At the initiation of a session between the client and the server, you would in fact see three connections. The first connection, the client is sent the flash. The second connection, the client includes the session string, which was generated by the flash. And the third connection, the client has a cookie, which allows him to bypass all of the other security mechanisms and continue using the site as normal. Because we require the client to have a valid cookie, we can also implement a simple form of IDS. Basically, what we can do is that if we detect any suspicious or malicious behavior on the part of the client, we drop his cookie into a sin bin, which is just a list of bad cookies. And any client who connects to our site with a cookie that's been blacklisted is simply forced to re-execute the flash and get a new cookie. And this means that any user or any system misbehaving that has a valid cookie will only ever be able to use that cookie once. And you can see an example of it over here. So once again, this does not make your system less vulnerable, but it does force the attacker to work very slowly and very carefully. And once again, this raises the cost for the attacker and evens the odds between the attacker and the defender. The last level at which we could implement this kind of strike back is at the data level. And we haven't given this a lot of thought, but there are some very good examples for it already in the world. A very classic example is the site www.whois.net. Whois.net is a Whois query proxy, and they allow you to look up who the registrar is of any given DNS domain. Of course, they want to protect themselves from spammers and other people who want to mine this data. What they could do is to block your requests after a certain number. That's a very common technique. But it's a very easy technique for the attacker to detect. And the attacker would simply get around it by backing away after a certain number of requests and then starting afresh with a new set of requests. What whois.net does instead is after a certain number of requests from the same client, they start to inject their responses with random fake data. And in this way, the information becomes useless to a user who's attempting to mine data. A user who's using the site for legitimate purposes will never get affected by this. And a user who's abusing the site will never know at which point the information that he gets back stopped being useful. And so once again we see that Strikeback is able to avoid hurting people who are just innocent bystanders. That brings me to the end of my presentation. I guess in conclusion, the point to bring home is that when administrators start to think like hackers, that's going to make the world a lot harder for hackers. I think the idea of Strikeback is an idea that was discarded a number of years ago already because of the risk of involving innocent bystanders. But I think that if one gives it a little more thought, then there are perhaps very legitimate forms of Strikeback which are at no risk of hurting the innocent bystander. And I think the idea of making the attack more expensive for the attacker is a very valid one, and perhaps an idea whose time has come. I thank you very much for your time, and I'm available for any questions if there are some. I believe we have about 5 minutes. Sorry, I was unable to hear that translation. Can I just verify it's in channel 2? The question is a very good question, and it's exactly the question that makes this topic very difficult. It was, if the attacker uses a stepping stone, in other words, he uses somebody else's infrastructure, somebody else's machine, as a launching point for his attack, then wouldn't that make the stepping stone the victim of the Strikeback attack? And the answer is yes, of course it would. And that's exactly the problem that we need to solve. And I think that some of the technologies that we demonstrated show that the problem can be solved. For example, the method that we use where we inject active content into HTML, that active content will be executed only in the browser where the attacker is sitting. So for example, if the attacker launches his attack via a proxy, the IP address that we would see for the attack would be the IP address of the proxy. But the actual content would be executed at the attacker's machine and not at the proxy. One point where that would be a problem is in the example we gave of the attack on the external. If the attacker had hacked somebody else's machine and was then using that machine to hack our machine, and we then executed malicious code on that computer, then yes, then that malicious code would be executed on the computer of an innocent bystander. But I think one could get away with that by not having to execute malicious code necessarily. Remember what I said, the objective for me with this kind of thinking is not necessarily to do the attacker harm, but only to make the attacker sufficiently concerned that he has to spend the same amount of time and effort ensuring that his own systems are secure and ensuring that he's also gone through lockdown mechanisms, that it evens the odds between me and the attacker. Does that answer your question? Thank you, that's a very good question. Are there any other questions? Yes, the question is whether this is viewed as complementary to other more, I guess, standard defensive technologies. And the answer is absolutely yes, it is, and it must be complementary. You could never use technology like this to replace or to supplement what are considered best practices in information security. The reason that we do this, the advantage that this gives us, which we didn't have before, is simply that, as I've mentioned previously, it raises the bar in terms of the cost of the attack for the attacker. The comment that I made right at the beginning of the session was, with current passive security technology, in essence what happens is that the attacker can attack and attack and attack and attack and attack at no real cost to himself. We are forced to defend the whole time, and the minute we make one mistake, the attacker wins and we lose. Whereas by implementing this kind of thinking, we make it more expensive for the attacker to attack and make him therefore less willing to attack repeatedly, to attack with the sort of abandon that attackers use at the moment. So that's the only additional advantage that this kind of thinking gives you over traditional network security thinking. Although I would like to perhaps add one more comment, which is that I think the principle of understanding the rules and breaking the rules the same way the attacker does could teach us a lot, apart from just using strike-back technologies. So currently, there's, as I pointed out in the beginning also, there's a set of attack ethics, I guess, which say rules are meant to be broken, and a set of defensive ethics, which say rules are meant to be followed. And I think that we could apply attack ethics to defensive thinking, then perhaps that would even the odds a little also. Are there any other questions? I think we have time for one last question. The question is, if one operates a system like this, then there is a chance that you are breaking the laws in some of the countries where the system might be implemented, and that the users of this system may be, in fact, I guess, breaking the laws in their own country, or perhaps breaking laws in other countries where the customers may sit. And the answer is yes, that is true. And that is why when we introduce the topic, we introduce the topic as a concept only. I think the moral and the ethical and the legal questions would still need to be studied in some detail before one could actually implement something like this in real life. However, if you look in our paper, you'll see that there are many other fields of study where this kind of thinking is perfectly legitimate. For example, in the concept of the just war. Under the concept of the just war, it is agreed, I think, globally, that there are certain conditions under which a country or a group of people who are under attack are justified in attacking back, provided that their attack can be justified and that their response is proportional to the attack itself. And there are some other premises also that go with it. My point is just, it's not a foreign concept. It's not a strange idea that if somebody attacks you in some way, that you attack him back. And so I think that these ideas can perhaps be questioned, and those laws can perhaps be questioned. Thank you very much. I thank you all very much for your time, and I'll be available for questions during the tea break or later, should you wish. Thank you.